Okay, we're talking about some of the affirmative action appointments and also the issue of the provost getting involved in the selection of the honors college director.
Well, the provost was supposed to be involved. It was his, you know, it was his, the director of the honors college reports directly to the provost, or it did in those days, and it's appropriate that he take a very close and direct interest. But Lee Winder, along with other provosts, were all engaged in this game of trying to hike the affirmative action statistics, hiring statistics. Mm-hmm. And Luana, too, later, much later. Okay? the one person who didn't do this with any real enthusiasm, though even he did some of it, was David Scott. And Larry Boger, I don't know what Larry Boger did, but Larry Boger, is he still alive?
No, he just died a couple months ago.
That's right, I thought I saw it. In that case, I am willing to tell you my anecdote about affirmative action and Larry Boger. When I was an academic administrative intern in the provost office, you know, that was a one-year job, there were several of them, one after another. That was a really plum assignment because you worked directly, in my case, with the assistant provost for undergraduate education, had an office up there, really learned how academic administration works. These were intended to be, it's an affirmative action program, it was, intended to get more women into academic administration is what it was for. And the assistant provost for undergraduate education, Dorothy Arata, was herself probably the highest ranking woman in the university at the time. And she and I became very close friends. And now, what was I going to tell you about the provost office?
And Larry Boger?
Larry Boger, yes. And when I went to the Honors College, when Jim Pickering recruited me to the Honors College, which would have been in 67, something like that, 67, 68. The sisters raised a stink because they thought it was the wrong appointment. It was one of those which they said, well, you may have had a person who is technically a woman, but she's not a woman in terms of where she stands and what she believes and whatnot.
You see? Ideology. Yeah.
Yes. So they had objected to him, who was the provost at the time. And he was a man who was just incredibly good at picking up every bit of gossip there was in the whole universe. He knew everything. I mean, he was really a gossip addict. Mm-hmm. And one day, after he'd been appointed to the job in Arizona, and we had just finished a long, contentious academic council session at which we had both been present. It was a week before he left campus. He said, will you give me a lift back to the ad building? And I said, I'd be delighted. Although he usually walked, I always drove, but he usually walked across the bridge. You know, why did he need a ride? You'd want to know why he needed a ride? Because he wanted to tell me something very confidentially. And in the car between the International Studies Programs building and the ad building, driving around past Erickson, he said to me, the sisters are really after you, and I don't want to alarm you. But he said, just watch your back, will you? I mean, he meant in academic politics. Mm-hmm. And this phrase, just watch your back, the implication was because he wouldn't be here to watch for me, you see? Mm-hmm. So now you have me located in terms of the political spectrum, or one dimension of the political spectrum, okay? And I was always very grateful to him for that.
In the other, in terms of academic governance, were you involved later on, later in your career?
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. In fact, I looked, to refresh my memory, I looked for my vita and I just couldn't find it. you know, this means I've been retired a long time because one thinks of that as practically, you know, like one's soul or something. But I have served on virtually every major committee in the university, mm-hmm. both appointive and elected. I've served in the academic council, I don't know how many terms. There are some statute of limitation, but because I was served first from Madison and then from the Honors College, you know, I sort of got a double dose.
You were, had a familiar seat or familiar yeah. face.
And I was on the, what used started as the Educational Policies Committee became the Academic Policy Committee, of which I became chairman. And this was, yeah, this was during the sisterly period, too, because I remember the first, my first, no, do you want to hear this now or not? We can let it go. But it does demonstrate the kind of things the sisters were worried about. There is a very serious psychologist who represented the College of Social Science at the meeting at which I was, you know, my first chairman session of the Academic Policy Committee. And so we sat around this table, you know, one, it was always a Noah's Ark committee, one from every single college and one or two spares. And she said, this psych professor, said, well, now that we at last have a woman as chairman, let's get rid of this chairman bit and let's change the language and the minutes and the official statements of the committee to chairperson. And I said, I'm not doing it. I'm not a chairperson, I'm a chairman, just like any other chairman. And anybody who understands the way the English language evolves knows that the term chairman can be perfectly well applied to a female as to a male. And if you insist on having a chairperson, you'll have to find somebody else, I said. And I went right on being a chairman. But this is the kind of nonsense that went on all the time. On the affirmative action thing, I want to tell you an anecdote about Wharton. I got to know him reasonably well because, he was interested in my field, development economics. You see, he was a very important Ford Foundation.
In Southeast Asia.
In yeah. Southeast Asia, mm-hmm. which was my geographic area, mm-hmm. and in Ag Econ, mm-hmm. which. And in fact, I had him once or twice as a guest speaker to my classes in Madison. But we had this common interest. And of course, he knew me from the Academic Council because I was not exactly a silent member. And he once called on me in the Academic Council and said, Ms. Smith. And I went and spoke and so on. Then I sent him a note in which I said what I used to say to people all the time who insisted on making an MS out of me. I started out saying, since I am neither a motorship nor a manuscript, I do not answer to MS. Okay? And in any case, said I, and now playing just a joke on this sort of compulsively statistical game one plays in politics, proving everything with, you know, statistics of dubious relevance. And I said, in any case, I'm sure you will find, this was in my note to Wharton, who were friendly, you know, we were friendly. I said, in any case, I'm sure you will find that 99.123456678 ever married women prefer to be called Mrs. And I sent him this thing. And I got a note back, and he said, I didn't think of calling you Ms. Not intentionally. And then he said, it must be my Brer Rabbit patch. He sort of said something about rubbing his darky head about, it must have been his southern darky accent that made him sound like thing, which was a very funny reply, you know. And 6 months later, I mean, this sounds really uncanny, which is why it makes such a wonderful anecdote. 6 months later, he sent me a little bitty clipping from the Chicago Tribune, which said something like 93.25% of all women who have ever been married prefer to be called Mrs. Mrs. It happened. Yeah. I said it as a gag. Mm-hmm. He took it as a gag. Mm-hmm. And then 6 months later, he sent me this note saying it wasn't a gag.
You were right on your statistics.
So that was Wharton. But why were we talking about presidents?
Well, you were mentioning the affirmative action, and then you mentioned the affirmative action of the statement of President Wharton.
Yes, 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 yes.
When did you retire?
89. Mm-hmm. 89. I was 67 when I retired. Yeah, that's figures, because I was born in 22. Mm-hmm. So the arithmetic seems to work. Mm-hmm. But the last year I was on, in those days we had those lush retirement consultantship, which were really sinecures, mm-hmm. you know. Although I did, it turned out, have a very stressful and serious job, but that hadn't been part of the deal. It happened later. I'll tell you about that in a minute. But anyway, I retired, yes, in 69, at 67.
Or 89?
In, yeah, in 89, mm-hmm. at 67. I wouldn't have retired. Well, that's a different story. That's another one of my big issues. One is affirmative action, and the other one is people who think they own their jobs. You know, tenure, what I consider the misuse of tenure. But we'll talk about that another time, and really. Well, I don't know. What time is it? It's 12 o'clock. Now, what was it that came up that I said I wouldn't?
Just it was something involved in your consultantship that you were, or the issue of age retirement, or?
Yes, the consultantship put me under absolutely no obligation. It was really a year's pay without mm-hmm. a year's work, you know. But I hadn't been gone a month before David Scott called. And David Scott was one of these real manipulators, you know. If he wanted, he could get anything out of you he wanted. I mean, he just... just oodles of charm, and anyway, he was one of my favorite provosts. In any case, he didn't call me at in daytime. He called at 9 o'clock at night to make it sure how seriously he was taking. You know, I would realize how seriously he took this. He asked me to be an external rep, the provost's rep, on the Academic Policy Committee while it was redoing the catalog. This was a very serious political job, because it was when after the change to semesters, when many, many courses, of course, had to change because, you know, they were the wrong length, and mm-hmm. very often the subject matter had to be rejiggered to fit the semester program. And that meant that all the catalog descriptions were being rewritten. And there's a lot of politics that goes into that. I won't enlarge on this now. But again, the sisters were at it. You know, everything was supposed to be gender-free. Mm-hmm. And you're not supposed to have annotations, course descriptions, that use the word he or she, you know, he, unless you made it both. And then there were the religious fanatics, or the third world fanatics, who didn't think that BC was a permissible description of a date, mm-hmm. you know? Mm-hmm. So now they say BCE, but in those days, I don't know what they said, but said something really weird. So the rewriting of the catalog involved a lot of this political symbolism that was so rife, you know, among various interest groups. Oh, not to mention the special ed people who had the unbelievable circumlocutions that were used. You couldn't say retarded people. You couldn't, mm-hmm. you know, challenged. This was when the word challenged mm-hmm. first became a euphemism for retired. Anyway, there were other political issues. There were many of them. And David Scott very ingeniously. I mean, again, I don't know this, but I believe that this is the way a talented administrator works. He knew that I was no shrinking violet. He knew exactly what my views were on a lot of these issues because we were friendly. He knew that if I was there, I would really put up a good fight no matter how heavily biased the distribution of opinion was on some other side. And he knew most of all that being retired, I had no career to protect. See? And therefore, if he wanted somebody who would say things he couldn't say, and who could take the consequences because there was no professional reason for ducking. Yeah. And so I spent a very bloody year on the committee fighting all manner of things. Right? This was not the only one, the one about the catalog. There were other major decisions that were being made. And so I worked very hard and for a year during this last year, 89, we said, right? Mm. So that was, I had another provost that stuck me in a job outside representing the provost. That was Larry Boger, when they were searching for a new dean of the College of Agriculture, which in this university, as you know, is a very important job. I mean, that dean politically may be the most important dean of all. You know, when it comes to the legislature and the mm-hmm. the public out there. And the College of Agriculture has bylaws under which, in addition to the properly constituted group within the college, which included extension agents, there's also to be a provost representative. Now, Larry Boger was the provost, so it was his college that was searching for a dean. But I was the academic administrative intern. Oh, that's how I got off the subject. Up there in the provost office. And he, with a straight face, simply appointed me as his rep on the dean search committee, which took 7 months. Mm-hmm. And I've not forgotten the name of the dean we came up with. I'm sure that a record of the university would show.
Was it James Anderson?
Yes. He's the one that had the deaf child. Yes, it was. Yeah, right.
He preceded Fred Poston.
Yes, it was. Yeah, that's who it was. Right. Mm-hmm. It took us 7 months, and I still think he was a good choice, even though he ran afoul. You know, the political mill in this university has ground up many good administrators. Mm-hmm. I mean, they do get, I don't know whether still, but historically, a number of very good administrators got destroyed by the political meat grinder in the university. Mm-hmm. I'd forgotten one of my favorite provosts, who was a case in point. Boy, I'm not going to make myself popular with a lot of people. With luck, by the time this happens, they'll be dead and I'll be dead, and then we won't care. But I forgot about Cantlin. Mm-hmm. Another one of these lovely, saintly men, you know, just an unbelievably decent, warm-hearted man, and a serious policy science expert. You know, he was a good man. But anyway, he got destroyed by political pressures. But they then sort of, instead of just grinding him up to nothing, he then became graduate research dean. Mm-hmm. And he had many years of useful service in that role. But, I was getting off onto provosts and their political skills. Mm-hmm. I know what I was saying. They need political skills. You can't fault them for being highly political animals, mm-hmm. because if you're not political enough, you get your throat cut. Don't you have to stop? It's
well, let me just ask kind of a concluding question then. In looking back on your career here at Michigan State, is there anything that comes to mind as being most important? I mean, you're a scholar with a background from international background and classically trained intellectual. In looking at the history of Michigan State while you're here, anything comes to mind as being most important that you see?
This will sound like a PR release for the university, but I think the university's mission is enormously important and worthy, and that is to bring not just job skills, but education to the masses. I used to call this the People's University, as against Ann Arbor. Mm-hmm. And in a way, I'm much more at home at Ann Arbor. But the home I really cherish is this. I mean, it's partly my socialist past, you know, that I believe that the common people ought to, are trainable and teachable and should be able to rise to the highest positions, and that they should enjoy the finer things of life. And in the old days, when the university was in its heyday, we had half of our students, when I was at that time very active, half of our students were the first in their family to go to college. And I thought that was magnificent, and I thought they ought to, I wanted them to get as much of what I had as possible, you know. Mm-hmm. And they did, and that is the great thing about this university. It has always been respectful, in the past at least, respectful both of the dignity and premise of the common man, and also respectful and genuinely devoted to highly intellectual, cultural, scientific things. I mean, it was genuinely devoted to the higher learning. It was genuinely devoted to mediating that higher learning to people who didn't even know what they were missing. Okay? And they thought they were here so they could get a good job. But I knew they were here, that I had a few years in which I could wise them up to the really interesting and good things in life. And this business of bootlegging culture and civilized behavior and intellectual interests into a vocational institution, that is what to me was the really outstanding and lovable and wonderful thing about Michigan State.
Interesting perspective. I want to thank you on behalf of the project, and I appreciate the time you spent and also your insight.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It was a pleasure.